Hi there. Time for Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross. This is where Wisconsin, Western Wisconsin, congregates each week to mingle at the places and with the people who provide the arts, music, and humanities that are so much a part of our culture and lifestyle. I'm the fortunate guy who gets to bring it all to you. Today, it's a smashing, in the positive British exclamatory sense of the word, a smashing collision, yes, between music and science. A collaboration that provides strange bedfellows and proves that they can actually have the same dreams. It's happening at UW-Eau Claire next week. We have some of the dreamers. We'll meet Kevin Peters, artistic director for the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra, with a bit about himself and a lot about their upcoming fall concert. Jim Oliver is here with a guest who was president of the Western Wisconsin Christian Writers Guild with a look at how they add spirit to their literary experiences. Jim also stops by with a compendium of theater productions one can find and attend in coming days and weeks in Western Wisconsin. And we begin today with something that we're all pretty good at. We do it every day, but it's still a lot of fun when we give it a name, learn more about it, and try it in new settings. Improv, short for improvisation. And when it comes to improv, there's nothing condensed about the way Abby Lavelle dives into it. She's also not reluctant about sharing the joy of making things up while interacting with others. In fact, she hosts programs that attract people like you and I into that joy. One is Improv Playground, coming in December to the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin, where Abby spends a lot of time and from where she spoke with me earlier this week. So let's talk about So Good Improv, that troupe. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's so much fun, and it's so cool to be a part of. So the So Good Improv troupe is through Festival Theater every summer. We have our summer company come in, and we do improv every Friday night. We don't do our normal theater program. We do improv, and it's usually about an hour and a half show, and it's the entire company. So when the company comes for the summer, we have three different shows that we're putting on, and not everyone is in every show, so it's our chance once a week to get the entire company together and just kind of play on stage. And it's always really well attended this summer. We sold out a number of shows.
Cool.
And it's always just so much fun to do, yeah.
Do you take it on the road, too? Do you go to other venues?
No, we haven't taken So Good on the road yet.
You're going to have to, though, I understand, because there's
some
remodeling coming up.
So, yeah, the plan for next year, Festival Theater actually resides in a building owned by the city of St. Croix Falls. The city is in works and is planning to renovate the building next year. So in 2016, we're moving shop. We're going to be not even a block away. We're going to be right across the street in the Franklin Square building. And we're going to set up a little storefront theater. We're hoping we can get about 50 seats in there and do some theater that way, which will be really fun.
Oh, yeah. So what's your background? Where are you from originally?
So I was born and raised in Iowa City, Iowa, and I did a lot of theater there and then went to college in Appleton, Wisconsin, studied theater and then got a concentration in neuroscience and a minor in psychology. Because I can't do just one thing at once. Then I moved to Frederick, Wisconsin, up here with Northwest Passage, the mental health service provider for teens. And I was an intern with their In a New Light program, which does photography and arts education programming with the kids there as an alternative form of therapy and something that they can do that's healthy and productive and to give them some new healthy coping skills and ways of expressing themselves.
Cool.
And I started bringing improv to the company up there. And
really?
Then I have numerous jobs here at Festival, which is super fun. I work in the box office. I'm also a marketing assistant, but I also work with the company. I was in a show this summer. I was in A Streetcar Named Desire. Tennessee Williams knows what he's doing. I also do some technical work. I stage managed for the complete works of William Shakespeare, Bridge Revised, which is a very improv-heavy show, actually. A lot of audience participation, so it was really fun to watch.
Wow. You clean the bathrooms, too?
If they're dirty, yep.
Yeah, wow.
I'll jump in there, yeah.
Wow, that's you're a team player.
Oh, yeah.
You've had some pretty rewarding experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
Good
I'm very, very blessed and have been able to do quite a lot. I still help up at Northwest Passage. I do some shifts every once in a while when I have some free time because those girls are just so near to my heart, and I usually try to bring. Mm-hmm. I usually try to do an hour or so of theater programming when I'm able to get up there, which is always fun.
You've worked with a couple of other improv groups.
So in college is when I started doing improv, and I was with the Optimistic Feral Children, which is a very fun name we came up with for ourselves. And then when I moved to the cities, I got up with Blackstirt Improv, and that's a community theater in Hastings. They're so much fun to play with, and they're now some of my closest friends, which is always fun. And then, so this summer, I was with So Good Improv here at Festival, and then the Improv for Youth program here at Festival. Usually we do a summer conservatory program where we get some youth involved in our shows and things like that, and this summer we did improv.
On the telephone with Abby Lavelle. She is, well, she's a whirling dervish, I guess we should call her, because she does she does a lot of stuff. The reason we're talking to her, among wanting to get to know her better and enjoying that experience, she is hosting and mentoring a program called the Improv Playground at the Festival Theater. That's coming in December, and it's time to learn more about that, Abby. This is for 13 and older. Is there a science to that age? Is there a reason that improv is best for 13 and older? Although I'm sure that you've worked with much younger people.
Yeah, the idea of 13 and up, and that goes all the way through adults. We want all ages coming to this program.
Okay. But we all need a playground no matter what age we are.
Yeah, I always refer to it as play. Improv is very joyous and very playful, the way that I experience it. Anyone who's under 13, while amazing in improv, it's even more like play for them. And it's a little harder to get a little bit more structure around it.
Sure.
They just want to go. And that's, while that's amazing, that's kind of a whole different way of structuring it. Mm-hmm. Versus as soon as you kind of hit that high school age and adults, they can kind of be grouped together.
Well, you know, when I was thinking about improv for kids, and get ready, because this is deep, I concluded that before a certain age, almost everything a kid does is improv because they've never done it before. It's
right.
New. They haven't experienced enough of life, so they're just kind of going by the seat of their pants, as they say. That is kind of deep, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could get even deeper and say, you don't script any of your everyday conversation.
True.
So everything, even though you have experience and that we've been through this, oh, I've had a conversation with this human before, we know kind of how we go back and forth, but everything that you're doing is really, it's all improv.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different aspects of improv that kind of help assist in that. And that might also be getting back to the idea of yes and full agreement and just accepting what someone else is giving you. That is their reality. Okay, let me build on that.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe kids are just automatically really good at that. They're so good at playing pretend.
Sure.
Okay, you're going to be the dog in the family, but you talk? Cool. When we're playing house, my house has a talking dog. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be the mom, but I'm 3 years old and a boy. Go for it. They're so much more willing to just say, okay, I accept that reality. And that's something that you kind of have to relearn as you get a little older. You're kind of like, wait, but that's not how I see the world. But that can be how you see the world, and I can accept that, and I can add something on and make it even cooler.
The course that you're teaching in December focuses on the basics of improv. What are the basics of improv?
The fundamental basic of improv is what I was already talking about, which is the yes and. When you're going into a scene and you're with your partner, you have to accept what your other partner is saying to you. So if I come into a scene and my idea in my head is, oh, we're going to be blacksmiths from the early 1800s, and it's going to be awesome. But my scene partner is sitting here thinking, like, we're going to be in the future on this spaceship.
Hmm.
And they come in and they say, like, aren't you so glad that we're on this spaceship together?
Mm-hmm.
If I say, like, no, we're not on a spaceship, we're blacksmiths, that's going to destroy the entire reality of the scene.
Sure.
And that's going to destroy all of the ideas that my scene partner so lovingly brought. So it's both of our jobs as scene partners. And you say, oh, I'm so glad we're on the spaceship together. And I can bring my idea as well. So I can say, yes, we're on this spaceship and we're blacksmiths in space. And how much better is that scene? How much more fun is that scene? Because I'm agreeing, you established a reality. Yes, that's an awesome reality you established. Let me add to it. Let me build on that and make it even better.
It's a pretty nice spaceship, but where do you keep the horses?
Yeah, and then we can go into a whole thing about having horses in space, using all the super old technology while on this new technology, like, oh, we're on this spaceship, but, you know, I better pull out my typewriter to tell Houston what's going on. Like, and there's so much more fun stuff versus saying, like, what, you're crazy. We're not on a spaceship. This is ridiculous. You can build so many more new ideas when you can combine all the things that people have to the table.
I'll bet that you have seen some amazing results in people after having gone through improv training.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that has developed in me, too. Improv is really good with that yes and. You have to listen to your partner to to your scene partner in order to agree with them. You can't just agree with them if you don't know what's happening.
We're not all good listeners, are we?
We're not. It takes a lot to kind of train that into you, which is always really interesting. But one thing that I've noticed with myself and with a lot of my teammates is being present and being in that moment. Because when you're doing improv, you can't be somewhere you're not. If you're not in that scene and you know exactly what's happening in that moment, if you're thinking about laundry that you have to do later and all this other stuff, you can't really think about that while you're creating a whole different world for yourself.
No,
you kind
true.
Of have to stay exactly where you are, which is always such a blessing.
I envision improv being good in all aspects of one's life, even on the job.
Yeah. Okay. I understand that that's true for you. And let me add what I have to say on it. That's something that's so helpful. In a board meeting, instead of having an argument with someone, if you're saying, oh, this is the best decision for the company, like we should spend this money this way, and someone else is like, no, because there's other reasons. But if you can say, yes, I understand that you don't think this is the right solution, and let me give you some more information that you don't have about that option.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really something like the give and take and listening and adding your information respectfully. It's so helpful in any job, in any relationship, in any sort of situation.
Everyone who may not have time to come to a class like you're putting on at the mm-hmm. Festival Theater, is there improv at home? Are there exercises a person can do to be better at the things that we've talked about?
Well, I think just practicing listening. If you're having a conversation with someone, put your phone down, turn your phone off, and actually spend some time with those people. Basic listening skills are definitely something. And you can watch Whose Line Is It Anyway. A lot of people have seen Whose Line. But you can also pull up so many college improv teams.
Oh, okay.
My old improv team still posts our videos. Watching improv. Going and supporting your local theaters and things like that. But you can play a lot of little games and things like that. You can play just different weird word association games.
Mm-hmm.
It's surprisingly fun if you start playing them a lot. Trying to get to a really weird place from a starting word like dog, you can end up on a spaceship, on Mars, in a clam store in the middle of New Hampshire. Like, you can go a lot of different places and just kind of letting yourself be creative in whatever ways that you like to create. Just accept that and build upon what you already have. I can't imagine that ever being detrimental.
Coming up with your own kinds of games is improv mm-hmm. in itself.
Yeah. Remember it's, when you were six and you were like, let's play house or let's play fortress. The ground is lava. What happens if the ground is lava? Just play. That's really what improv is. It's just a little bit structured in a different way than what we're used to.
The play is the reason it's called Improv Playground. It takes place mm-hmm. Wednesdays, December 2nd, 9th, and 16th. That's in the evening at the Festival Theater. That's in St. Croix Falls. That's Abby Lavelle on the phone with us. Abby, thanks so much for being with us. By the way, is that you awkward dancing?
Probably.
The Awkward Dance Wednesdays. That's quite a group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a lot of fun that my friends and I had in college. That's all I'm part of it. Just play. Play a song and dance as weirdly as you can for 4 minutes and see what happens.
Yeah, I loved it. I'm going to go back. I'm a fan mm-hmm. now.
There you go.
I'm going to do my own awkward dancing. Abby Lavelle, thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West. Mm-hmm. Keep up the great work, and we'll come to see you someday.
Awesome. We look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Awkward Dancing Wednesdays, that's something I found in Googling her name. So you'll find it, too, kind of YouTube videos. They're fun to watch. Feels almost like a workout talking with that bundle of energy. Again, the class is Improv Playground. It's for ages 13 to adult, coming in December, and the festival website is Festival Theater. That's with an R-E at the end, not E-R, .org. Might be just what the doctor ordered. Coming up, music and science mingle. The man with the Red Cedar Symphony baton and Jim Oliver is next. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Luther College, where campus visits can include talking with professors, coaches, and conductors, staying in residence halls, joining music rehearsals, and more. Visit information is at luther.edu. Support also comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, dedicated to offering expertise and solutions for a variety of women's health issues. More information is available on the obstetrics and gynecology page at Mayo Clinic Health System. Here's a Spectrum memo. Off Center is the name of the annual exhibit from the Valley Art Association and the Beaver Creek Photo Club. It's up at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls through the 25th. Tonight, Thursday, from 6 to 9, it's the anticipated Taste of the North, the 10th annual, celebrating hand-picked food and beverages of Northwest Wisconsin. It's a big fundraiser for the Heide Center. See the Heide Center in all its glory. Saturday, Michael Perry stops by the Heide, and it's called Is He Still Yappin'? Freewheeling Behind the Pages, he's calling it. Hilarious, heartfelt, and as I say, here we go again. Should be fun. Heide Center website is cvca.net. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you here. Writers come in all shapes, sizes, ages, and inducements and inclinations, as you will discover in this week's Oliver Report.
The Western Wisconsin Christian Writers Guild meets the second Tuesday of every month, September through May, at Bethesda Lutheran Church on Hamilton Avenue in Eau Claire. There is networking and fellowship time, a speaker, and best of all, great snacks. Here to talk about the Writers Guild is this year's president, Sheila Wilkinson. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. We always like to talk about writing and all the fun things that writers get to do in between sitting in their dark corner putting words on paper.
Well, tell us about how the Christian Writers Group got started and when.
It started in the year 2000 when a local writer, Mary Pierce, got tired of sitting in her corner and being alone. And she put a little ad in the newspaper inviting other Christian writers to a meeting to see if anybody was interested. She got a group together with that one meeting, and it has been going ever since.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about Christian writers, what does that mean?
Well, there's no litmus test at the door. Mm-hmm. We profess to be Christians. Mm-hmm. Some of us write Christian works, and some of us write for the secular market. Coming from a Christian worldview probably does affect the way we write and things we say and our purpose in writing. So we have a common ground to try to help one another get our message across, whether they're Christian or not.
You have a verse of the year, which I think is unique to a lot of organizations. How do you select that?
The board gets together, and we all have a few favorites that we might like. We choose them from the Bible. Sometimes it's just verses that we have come across in our own reading, and we think that, oh, this is about writing, and it's inspirational for anybody who wants to use the arts. So we put it on a list, and as the board looks at all of them, we have a vote, and we've never had a fist fight. We've come up with a new verse of the year every year.
Why don't you read the one that you have for this year? It's from Jeremiah, as I recall.
It's taken out of context, but it's Jeremiah 30, verse 2. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Write in a book the words I have spoken to you. So we hoped that with this verse, people would understand that God does want us to use our gifts and to write and get those words down.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many members do you have, and do you have a limit?
The limit is probably what fills the room. I think right now our membership is about 25. It varies anywhere from 15 to 30.
Mm-hmm. That would be quite a chore for everybody to share at a meeting night, though, wouldn't it, for that many people?
In our regular meetings, there are things that the members can sign up for to participate in, but a lot of our meeting is for learning and instruction and listening to the speaker, whatever the speaker has to bring to us. For the members to share, we hold a special time. It's an hour before the regular meeting, and a small group of us get together. And we read our pieces to one another, and we try to help with things that need improvement. We try to tell each other what we're doing right. And that's very, very beneficial.
Now, do you have, I was going to ask first, are the members from the local area?
They come from a wide area. For a while, we had a lady coming down from Chautauqua. Now, I think our northernmost person is coming from New Auburn. We have a board member that comes all the way from Abbotsford. Mm-hmm. Durand, I believe. It varies. I think we've had members coming from Menominee, kind of a circular area, Chippewa Falls, obviously, and Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm. She is Sheila Wilkinson, who is president of the Western Wisconsin Christian Writers Guild. Do you have published writers in the group?
Yes, we do. In fact, one of our writers, she won a nationwide contest, the Women of Faith runs a contest every year, and the winner of the contest gets published through one of the publishers. Mary Pierce, who started the group, she's not in it right now, but she published, I believe, 3 books. Michelle Rayburn has a book out, Refurbished and Upcycled. Melissa Wiltrout has a young adult novel that has opened up a ministry for her in the juvenile detention center.
Talking about a typical meeting, what sort of an agenda do you have?
We will start with a short devotion, and that's one of the things that we open up for our members. They can give that devotion. We do announcements. We will announce any writing contests that are taking place, any conferences that people might be interested in. Then we do a 6 questions. We've done this forever. We ask questions like, have you written anything this month? Have you had anything published this month? Have you sent in any queries? Just an opportunity for the members to raise their hands and be a part and understand that we're there to encourage them. Then we do a show and tell. If you had something published in the past month, you can bring it or just stand up and tell a little bit about what it is you wrote, where you got it published, how you heard about that particular publisher. That way, more of our members get ideas about where to send their articles, where to look for book publishers. We do something called Your Turn. If you read something that was very interesting or helpful to other writers, or just you like the sound of the words, anything that you want to share with the group, you can get up and talk for a few minutes. And then we do the boot camp.
You have to describe that for me. That intrigues me, to say the least.
We have many beginners, and we have people who have written for years and years. So we want to provide something for everyone. And the boot camp is a way where we get down to basics. We remember those commas, and we remind people about different grammar rules and different literary things to use. And we've come to find out more than just the beginners need that. So we all need reminders of these rules that we hated in high school.
Tell me about the various kinds of writing that your members are doing.
We have a wide variety. Children's writers, published children's writers, and we have adult writers. Some write fiction, and some write nonfiction. Some who write strictly articles, others who write poetry. We try to incorporate all different types of writing, and we try to choose our speakers accordingly so that throughout the year, everybody will find something that they can benefit from. And we try to keep in mind that we have a wide variety. Many of the literary things that writers use can be used for both poetry and prose. In fact, if you write a lot of articles and books, one of the best things you can do is write some poetry because it helps your words sing. They sound better. And when you start doing that, then you go to write your articles and your books. And all of a sudden, that article sounds a lot nicer and it's more pleasing to the person reading and they want to read more. And that's really the object of it. I actually wrote a short thing for our Christmas party one year. And I used information that another lady took, and she wrote a poem about it. We can benefit one another that way, too.
Hmm. You know, that's an interesting point about the poetry tying together with prose, because there are a couple of book authors whom I interview on a quasi-regular basis, and they're both poets, but they write mysteries. And then they credit their poetry for their ability to write mysteries, you know, or just write prose, and it's fascinating. Well, you talked briefly about speakers. You do have that program every meeting, so
right.
Talk about that.
Well, so far this year, we've already had Cynthia Ruckte, published author out of Pittsville, Wisconsin. She has several books, taken many awards, and so she kicked off our year in September. And we've had Monica Holtz, who's gone from journalism to running her own publishing company, and now she's an administrator for the Friends of the Library. This month we are having Pastor Dan Stanley. He's going to speak on what the Bible teaches us about writers. In January, I believe it is, Nathan Anderson will come. He has written some marvelous young adult fiction, And so he's going to speak on the importance of story. So the story is important both to prose and to poets because it's in the story that you grab your audience.
You have a website.
The web address is simple once you realize what it stands for. We're from Western Wisconsin Christian Writers Guild, so the website is wwcwg.com.
Uh-huh. Now, I can tell you that the way I found it was just to Google the organization.
It took me many years to figure out all those letters, and I always Googled it.
So if I decide I want to come and join you folks?
Well, you got to find us on that second Tuesday night mm-hmm. at Bethesda. You come in the west door, and we're in room 305. You can visit for $7 for one meeting, or you can pay the year's dues, which is $30. We have many people just come and visit, and most of them stay around.
Well, it's the Western Wisconsin Christian Writers Guild. They meet the second Tuesday of the month from September through May at Bethesda Lutheran Brethren Church on Hamilton Avenue in Eau Claire. And we've been talking to the president, Sheila Wilkinson. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Oliver. I'm Al Ross. This is Spectrum West. We've been introduced to the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra here on Spectrum West. We've met board presidents, spoken with representatives about concerts and events, and have briefly met the artistic director, Kevin Peters. But today, we talk a bit more with Mr. Peters, a native suburban Milwaukeean, about his experience since then, and learn about the active schedule in which this impressive musical group finds itself. We reached Kevin Peters by phone a couple days ago. Started in Milwaukee, then where did you go?
And then to Appleton, I did my undergrad at Lawrence University, taught the 6 years there at Xavier High School, mm-hmm. and went out to Ithaca, New York, to get my master's degree in conducting at Ithaca College, and then returned to Northwest Wisconsin, because my wife's family is up there. Heard about the Red Cedar Symphony, and they were looking for guest conductors 1 year, and I got that, and one thing led to the next, and now I'm their artistic director.
I had a friend in Milwaukee. He went out and bought a baton, and he used to stand in front of his stereo and conduct. That was his way of working out.
I didn't go out and buy a baton, but I would turn the radio on and conduct things, usually in my room, sometimes in the car. But I definitely got involved in that from a young age. My mom was a music teacher, general music teacher, but I constantly had classical music playing or sometimes Herman and Turbitz playing. But I always was fascinated, you know, with the emotion of the music and found myself moving to it.
Well, he did it for the exercise. He used to come away just perspiring and saying, "This is my way of doing it." I said, "Well, you got to take care of your lower body, too." He said, "Yeah. Can you run and conduct at the same time?"
Yeah, come shake my hand after a concert, and I'll probably have lost a couple of pounds.
So conductors come in all shapes and sizes and energy levels. Another thing that fascinates me is the aspects of conducting. And what do you learn when you go for a formal education in the art of conducting? What's the most important thing that that a conductor must exude to the people he's conducting? Is it being interpreted correctly? Is it being a cheerleader? Is it what?
That's an interesting question. I get asked that question a lot. You know, there's so many different aspects that go into it, and it really depends on the group that you're working with. For me, it's in the preparation. I need to come into that first rehearsal knowing exactly what I want a piece to sound like, anticipating the challenges I'm probably going to encounter, then being able to, you know, work with the ensemble in achieving the goal that's in my head of what I want to hear. Some ensembles, it's allowing them to discover it. Some of them, it's showing it in my conducting. If I want something softer, I'm not going to be conducting in a huge gesture. Sometimes it's articulating that verbally, some words, some descriptions for them to try and match their sound to.
Oh, okay.
It's the verbal and nonverbal communication with an ensemble. The mix of that is very, very challenging, and being able to, you know, in the time frame that you have for rehearsals, that first rehearsal to the concert, being able to, you know, achieve your goals.
And I'm guessing facial expressions are pretty important as well. People can tell how well they're doing, I guess, how that last note was.
I was one-on-one with my conducting professor. I would sit there in his office and conduct. When you're conducting in a lesson, you sing the parts.
Oh.
He expects you to sing it in tune, and he might say, "Okay, jump to the cello line," and you've got to be able to sing that line and conduct. But Wow. He assigned me to go home and practice facial expressions in the mirror.
Wow. That
was my homework assignment. Because it's true. And he says, why did you smile there? Is the music happy? Or were you happy with what you heard? And, you know, there's some teachers who suggest don't smile. That takes the attention away. I like to let the players know that I'm appreciating what's coming. I liked what I've heard. Or let them know, I don't like what I'm hearing. Fix it. I think they pretty much have that figured out based on my facial expression.
Well, it's one thing to conduct an orchestra made up of highly paid instrumentalists, but from your perspective, it must be nice conducting a group like the Red Cedar Symphony, where people are playing simply because they love it.
It is. It's really enjoyable to conduct groups like that, and it's a completely different vibe in the rehearsal atmosphere and just working with them. You know, knowing that they're there because they love it, knowing that they're there because they want the musical outlet, they want the experience is great. You know, and you have a wide range of ability levels, too. Everyone is willing to work hard because, you know, they all want to be a part of something good, something that sounds good. And everyone works towards that, and it's up to me to choose a repertoire that will allow them to showcase their talents in the best way.
The release that I have before me talks about the membership, and I'm going to read the list because it's impressive. Cumberland, Ladysmith, Spooner, Exceland, Prairie Farm, Chautauqua, Trigo, Springbrook, Bruce, Hayward, Cable, Winter, Bloomer, Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and let's not forget Foster. We're on the phone with Kevin Peters. He's artistic director of the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra. They have their fall concerts coming up Saturday at 7 o'clock. That's 7 p.m. at Chautauqua Lutheran Church in Chautauqua, and then Sunday the 15th in the Red Cedar Symphony's home at the Fine Arts Center at UW-Barron County. That's at 4 o'clock. We are, in this concert, Kevin, going to recognize, they say, mileposts within Dvorak's ninth symphony. It has some pretty familiar stuff, does it?
It does. I think that a lot of people are going to recognize a tune from each of the movements in here. This is a masterwork, one of the most popular symphonies, I think, out there. And we're very excited. The orchestra is doing a great job with it. You know, Dvorak, it's subtitled From the New World, and a lot of people think he wrote it based on themes and such that he encountered all his time in the U.S., and ultimately he didn't use any original themes in the music. But there are kind of allusions to tunes woven in, including you'll hear a little bit of maybe Three Blind Mice. I think that's probably the most obvious one. You'll hear some of that. There's allusions to Swing Low, Sweet Cherry-O, a tune called The Little Alabama Coon, and even some hints of Yankee Doodle in there. So, yeah, there's definitely American influence in it, but the third movement is very Czech. Strong percussive Czech rhythms in there, and there's definitely a lot of influence of his homeland in this piece, too.
There are some other things on your fall concert program. Tell us about those.
There's three other great tunes in there. In the first half, I like to theme my concerts. I feel it helps me in programming. It helps an audience kind of understand a concept of the concert. So I chose a folk song suite by Ralph Vaughan Williams called English Folk Song Suite. Different folk songs and inspired by folk songs. This was actually originally composed for wind ensemble and then transcribed by Vaughan Williams' student, Gordon Jacobs, for full orchestra. It's just a delightful piece. It has three movements in there. It starts with a march and ends with a march, actually, and then has a gorgeous interlude in between those two marches. And then Ashokan Farewell, I think people will recognize anyone that's seen Ken Burns' PBS special on the Civil War. His Civil War documentary will probably recognize the melody of Ashokan Farewell. And then might seem like an uncharacteristic way to start an orchestra concert, but to me, there's no better way to get people excited and ready to open up their ears than Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever.
There you go.
There's no need to describe the inspiration of that one.
Not at all. You have a concerto competition thing coming up. Tell us about that.
We're encouraging anyone, two different performance divisions from college and under, and then anyone who's graduated college. If there's enough quality applicants, we'll choose a winner from each division and put them on to our spring concert. Looks like right now our spring concert is going to be UW-Barron County on Sunday, April 3rd. Waiting for final confirmation on that, but it's a great opportunity for local students who might not have the opportunity to perform as a soloist, especially with an orchestra, to apply and have that opportunity. We also want to get more students out to hear a live symphony orchestra perform. So the Red Cedar Symphony and its board of directors have instituted a new program which youth under the age of 21 may attend our concerts for no admission charge. That means for free.
Congratulations on your great work. I think people in places where they consider themselves Metropolitan would find it impressive the Red Cedar Symphony exists in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, much less thrives, or should I say much more thrives. So way to go, Kevin Peters.
Thank you.
The website is redcedarsymphony.org, and there you'll be able to pick up information not addressed here today, but we'll be following the escapades of this dynamic group of dedicated folks as time goes on. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering fixed-rate mortgages, adjustable-rate mortgages, WIDA, and federal VA loans for home buyers, refinancing, or building. WisconsinCU.org. Art and science, at one time perceived as incompatible as oil and water, but today, forward-thinking groups and individuals are looking for channels in which they can collaborate and conjure up fascinating ways to amalgamate. I love that word. One example happens in Eau Claire for the second time. It's called Waves, a celebration of astronomy and music. Today we're conversing with three participants. Paul Thomas, professor of physics and astronomy at UW Eau Claire. He's one of the guys behind the popular live Ask a Scientist presentations. You've heard of those, maybe been to some. Julie Mikowski Thomas, a very close associate and musician. And Teet Raid, UWEC art professor emeritus and sought-after percussionist. Paul Thomas begins our conversation with a portrayal of the first such collaboration last year.
My colleague Matt Jewell, who's a professor in material science at UW Eau Claire, came to me with the idea that he wanted to show a movie called Particle Fever. It's a documentary that profiled quite a few scientists that worked at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, where they discovered the Higgs boson. Matt worked on the magnets for the Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, really?
I admire him a lot. You know, I have quite a few colleagues at the university beautifully equipped to explore the space that encompasses both art and science, and I feel very fortunate to have them as colleagues. Matt wanted to show the Particle Fever movie at the university as a public event with a discussion. It turned out that I was in the early stages of working on this collaborative project with my wife Julie and later Teet and George Uphol. It suddenly occurred to us immediately that these two projects were really the same sort of thing.
Ah.
So we decided not only just to do these, but to do others that will come, and we have a sketchy idea of what we might do in the future, but to have this program called Art and Science, to go with the movie in November 2014, to develop this collaborative music astronomy program for November 2015, and then to encourage other projects to follow. So it was a beautiful bit of synchronicity in a way. We were both thinking along similar lines. And the showing was very successful. We did it in Woodland Theater. We had about 300 people turn up and a good discussion afterwards. Oddly enough, there was a snowstorm that day, so we were going to have some of the Large Hadron Collider team come up from Madison, but in the end they weren't able to.
Oh, that's too bad. Back in the genesis when this all began, you're telling me that the scientists get the credit for coming up with the idea. The musicians were just...
I certainly wouldn't say that about our project. In fact, I would say that Julie came up.
Because that was a question of mine. Who brought it up first, the scientists or the musicians?
Well, I had seen Paul give a talk out at Beaver Creek Reserve to the Astronomical Society. And I watched him and I thought, he is very poetic. And the way he delivers something, it looked like it just needed a score underneath it. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to provide that score?
Where did the score come from? Was it original or did you have to go find things or what happened?
It's been a long time coming. A lot of it, I've been just watching videos and doing a lot of listening to recordings and seeing what styles and what different effects we could add to this to bring out the science. And then I also use four written pieces, Claude Debussy, Gary Schocker.
Were they pieces that when you heard them or as you recalled them, you said, yeah, this fits really nicely?
What we would do is I'd find pieces that I loved and then I would... put them by Paul and see if you thought there would be a place for them in his talk. And then there's a lot of improvisation using a lot of different, like some native flute kind of a sound, some more Japanese sounding things, beatboxing. And then Teet joins in and brings in the percussion element.
We'll get to Teet in a moment. In fact, I'm surprised he's not playing something here, like playing the desk or playing his water bottle, because he does have that talent. I'm going to use the word invariably without really knowing, but I've found a lot of artsy people, and I use that as a respectful term, weren't fond of math and science. math most especially. In fact, it was those things and their lack of skill or motivation within the disciplines that I think propelled them in the direction of art or theater or music. Those things were kind of a refuge from math and science. Do you find a bunch of students who are talented and gifted in both science and art?
Yes.
You do?
But, you know, this is part of this old two cultures argument that dates back decades. What I would say is that in the physics and astronomy department, we've had a whole bunch of musical students who've been good physicists as well. My life's work is dedicated to the proposition that there aren't two cultures.
As a matter of fact, we have two people that are involved with this project that are providing art and music. We have Emily Watkins, who's a UW jazz student. Mm-hmm. She is a chemistry major and gigs around Eau Claire on guitar, and she's going to be providing prelude music, postlude music, that kind of a thing. And we have art by a student artist named Michelle Gervais. I think she graduated, right?
Yes.
And she was a chemistry major. So that combines those two cultures.
So the next time an artist comes up to me and says, I hated math, and then I say, you know, I did too, and I should have probably applied myself in math because I love music. Had I applied myself in math, I think I might have been better. What do you think about that, Teet?
Well, I wasn't very good at math.
No?
Or science. It required too much linear thought. Well, I didn't realize at an early age that I really didn't work that way. But when I learned about the two hemispheres of the brain, for example, where the creative side is on the right side, and intuition is there, I've always worked intuitively.
Yeah.
I just pay attention to what some people call it, my inward voice, and I follow it. I would respond very well to visual things.
It's probably why they put math problems on a chalkboard, because it was visual.
Well, that didn't work for me.
Okay.
But what did work for me, remember these intelligence tests, the variety that they used to give, and they had the form, a geometric form laid out flat?
Yeah.
I could figure those out for some reason. But put a math problem in front of me, and I had really a lot of difficulty with it. Mm. And I think it's just simply a matter that my natural brain worked in a different way. And the reason I got into art was not because I didn't like these areas. And later on in life, by the way, I found them very interesting. I listened to a lot of science programs because there's some wonderful things that come from that. But I was best at making pictures. Everybody that I went to school with, I was the artist of the class.
It may be the case, then, that we all have an aptitude for math and science. We just all bloom at different times.
Yeah.
Because I also find math interesting at this later stage, and science as well. It's fascinating to me.
There's so much that's beautiful about it. You know, Al, my thoughts turn to a couple of young faculty members I find inspiring in the way that they're able to bridge the gaps or the perceived gaps between these disciplines. B.J. Hollers, who may have been on your show, perhaps.
Last week.
Okay. You know, he's a live wire. He's a great English creative writing professor. But he writes about science and nature, and these are the things that really, really interest him. In the music department, Nick Phillips, who has worked with music compositions that evoke the idea of the Hubble Space Telescope. And I find it just absolutely inspirational to have colleagues like that. They realize it's one big thing. We come at it from different angles, but it's one big idea.
I wager they say the same about you, just so you know. In the studio with Paul Thomas, Julie Makowski-Thomas, and Teet Reid, a program that also includes George Uphall on piano. It's called Waves, a celebration of astronomy and music. It is next Thursday, the 19th, at 7 p.m. in the Ojibwe Ballroom of the Davies Center at UW Eau Claire. Teet, what does this kind of interaction do for a musician? What does it add to you as a percussionist?
Well, I feel very privileged to be part of this thing. In some respects, I'm not exactly sure why I was asked, but I think...
I'll bet you we can get clarification.
In the past, they must have got an indication that I knew something, you know, about playing music. Mm-hmm. I play totally intuitively. I have to hear a sound before I can add anything. And once I hear the sound and I know what my instruments sound like, then I know what to add. And music, for me, is a very, very intuitive thing, as is my painting. Mm-hmm, but the cool thing about music is that it's so immediate. You're in it. You know, whereas in painting, you something occurs to you. You might be there for 2-3 hours doing the same thing. whereas in music, it just progresses and goes on. And in a very relatively short period of time, you're part of a creation of a work. Seeing the images on the screen, various planets and so forth, and listening to Julie's playing, that gives me the idea of what to, you know, what to do. So I respond to both, the visual information and then the music. Music number one, and then the visual.
Intuition and inspiration, in a way, because you're visually inspired.
Yeah.
And then the intuition takes over.
Yeah, that's one of the only ways I know how to operate.
Well, good.
Quite frankly.
We have somebody on this show this week talking about improv, a lot of the same stuff. Is there a way to prepare yourselves for this kind of collision, or is it free and open-minded more than anything?
I think if you come with an open mind, prepared to experience a very eclectic mix of music from all around the world, an interest in astronomy, and an awareness that in the last few years, we've explored some amazing places, Pluto and its system of moons, and landed a spacecraft on a comet called Gerasimenko-Churyumov.
And finding things on that comet.
Things on that comet, like the chemical building blocks of life. If you are aware of those things and open to the idea of a evocative exploration of that, I think you'll be well served.
Okay, so you've given us ways to prepare as an audience. Do the participants have to prepare? When musicians put on shows, they rehearse.
At first, when Paul and I started putting this together, we didn't even know how to talk about what he was going to do and how I was going to come into it.
Okay.
How did we even discuss the way we were going to build this? And so we do practice. We practiced a lot. We rehearsed before we got together with Teet, and then Teet and Paul and I rehearsed before we got together with George. We've added a student who's going to be turning our slides for us. Lots of rehearsal.
It took us a while to figure out how to even write a script, as Julie said, because we would improv bits of it together, but it, in a way that it was kind of very hard to reproduce. So an illustrated script turned out to be the key, and then just rehearsal after rehearsal to make sure that the timing of it is right. And it's really become beautiful. I'm not a singer by any stretch of the imagination, and I don't intend to sing for this performance.
You could sing now, and we can be the judge.
Well, indeed.
Go ahead.
But I do, you know, I will speak in a measured tone that I hope will complement the different sorts of musical compositions that Julie and Teet and George will play. And there are times, sort of maybe a bit like a narrated movie, where you hear the same musical theme underlying a statement that you're making, and it, to me, is quite magical.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about ancient water on Mars that's long gone, for example, and these musical themes swell up underneath you, and it really is, it's almost like a scene from a motion picture. It's very powerful. So we do hope that the audience feels some of that emotion. It's an amazing story we have to tell, and it's been wonderful mapping the way to do this. This is really very much a one-shot deal. We don't intend to do this performance again, and we spent a lot of time trying to get it right. I hope the audience feel that they're looking at a single, very, very emotionally stirring composition of light and sound and voice.
I was thinking as you were speaking there about how often the music in a motion picture enhances what we're going through, enhances the emotion, and usually that's a giant symphony orchestra. You would think that a collaboration with this same kind of visual enhancement would be kind of, you talk about emotion.
We would be open to continuing this. The process of doing this has been wonderful. For example, Julie did an enormous amount of research on the musical compositions that we would use. There was a time when she said, well, I've discovered this new flute composition. It's from Japan, and it's
Shakuhachi
flute. And I said, well, I know about that. And we discussed why I knew. And it's this sort of flute composition that Carl Sagan recorded on the Voyager Interstellar Record, the long-playing record that was bolted to the side of the Voyager spacecraft and launched over 30 years ago. So I had heard that music before. And no doubt it had impressed Sagan and his team in the same way that it impressed us. It's beautifully stimulating. It sounds variously like birds or something like that. So it's on its way to the stars. But it's also part of our presentation, and that was completely independent.
There are more and more instances in which art and science are collaborating.
I am very grateful to be a professor at UW-Eau Claire. I've never felt the so-called traditional barriers between collaboration in the arts and the sciences here. traditionally, at many universities, the idea for a scientist would be, well, that's very nice. Mm-hmm. That's a hobby, and it's not something you take seriously. But I felt throughout my career at UW-Eau Claire that this has always been something that everyone has appreciated. Mm-hmm. And in fact, encouraged.
Well, I think if you guys wheel out a telescope, the scientists can look through it and Teet can play it. What do you think?
I agree.
What, the telescope or what I see?
Doesn't matter. You'll find a way. This is delightful. The show is 7 p.m. Thursday, the 19th, Ojibwe Ballroom, UW-Eau Claire. If you haven't had enough here, just go to the show. You'll get all you need to know. Paul, Julie, and Teet, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Al.
Thanks to all of you. Spectrum West wouldn't be complete without weekly involvement from Jim Oliver. Here's the West Wisconsin theater scene.
Thank you, Al. The University of Wisconsin Stout Theater production of the classic Greek tragedy Antigone will be performed through Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Ole and Lena's Family Christmas will be presented Saturday and Sunday afternoons at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Escanaba in the Moonlight will be staged by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Into the Woods will be performed Friday through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show continues through November 29th. Auditions for Radio Days 2 will be held Monday and Tuesday from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Phipps. Auditions for a Wide Spot Readers Theater production of the radio version of It's a Wonderful Life will be held at 6:30 p.m. Monday and Tuesday at the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm. And that's some of what theater companies around the region are doing for Spectrum West. I'm Jim Oliver.
Thank you. Spectrum Memo tonight, Thursday, Cranford Hollow sneaks backstage for a concert at the State Theater in Eau Claire. 7:30 p.m., Jason Isbell performs Friday night at the State's website is eauclairearts.com. The Ask a Scientist series, by the way, presents a high school teacher's perspective on math anxiety. That's next Wednesday, 7 p.m., Acoustic Cafe in Eau Claire. Hannah sends out the heads-ups. Debbie keeps us on time and looking good. And Dean cracks a whip we look forward to. No, not in that way. Thanks to all of them. Next week, a theater with an international charm, a 3D conversation about Santa Claus and a mystery, music news times 3 coming out of Menominee, and more. On Spectrum West, I'm Al Ross. Thank you.